Thank you very much, Findlay. I should start with an apology. I was intending to produce a sort of abstract or summary of my paper, but I went on holiday instead. And by the time I got back, it was a bit too late, so apologies for that. I'm certainly not going to try and read the paper, but I will speak to the sort of highlights and try and summarise the argument. The reason for tackling the paper is that I've had a long-standing interest in miscarriages of justice, and non-disclosure by the prosecution has been implicated in, of course, many notorious cases of miscarriage of justice. These go back certainly to the early 1990s and beyond. One can think of cases like Judith Ward, Sally Clark, and there are a number of other very well-known ones. And of course, everyone will know that there's been a whole series of recent cases of non-disclosure which have led to collapsed prosecutions. They've had massive media coverage starting sort of early December and going on into 2018. Reflecting on those cases, I was reminded of a comment that the late and much missed Mike Redmayne made in an article in 2004. When he said, disclosure has always been a problem, and very probably always will be, whatever regime is adopted. And those recent cases certainly seem to bear out the justice of that comment. And then some further reflection led me to add up the number of official reviews that we've had of disclosure over the last 20 years since the CPIA regime was introduced, and I make the total of 8. And that's not including the reviews of individual cases like Liam Allen, which was one of the recent ones. So 8 official reviews of disclosure in 20 years is going some. And I can't think of any other subject in criminal process which has had quite that number of official studies. Now, all those reviews have made recommendations to improve disclosure, but as the recent cases show, the problems clearly remain. And so I thought it'd be interesting to revisit these problems, and I want to focus particularly on the two most recent official reviews. And at this point, what I want to do is just summarise the argument that I'd like to present. And the argument goes along the lines that I think there's a lot of value in those reviews, but they are insufficiently probing as to the underlying causes of the problems with disclosure that they've identified. And in particular, I want to suggest that they failed to address the issues of police and prosecution culture, which Hannah Quirk identified in an article that she published some years ago. And I think these cultural issues are highlighted by the recent cases, and the recent cases also give rise to some additional concerns. And the burden of my argument is that it seems to me that we've come to the point where it's not sufficient to call, as the reviews have done, for police and prosecutors just to do their jobs more efficiently and to call for changes in their occupational culture. And I think it may be time that we considered some more radical measures, including some alteration of the institutional arrangements for disclosure. And I have in mind particularly that the recent cases have nearly all involved sexual offences, and they've nearly all involved what I would call credibility contests between complainants and defendants. And by that I mean, basically, these are cases where the complainant alleges that she was raped, the defendant said it was consensual, there's very little other evidence, and the question is, who do you believe? And I wonder, and I'm going to suggest this as a sort of final point, that there may be a case for outsourcing disclosure decisions in cases like this, perhaps as a pilot study. And I'd be very interested to hear what the practitioners in particular have to say about that. Okay. Just to clarify the scope of the paper, I'm not going to discuss the importance of disclosure. It seems to me that the arguments for proper disclosure are just compelling and relatively non-controversial, so I'm happy to talk about those in discussion later, but I'm not going to deal with them now. I'm also not going to say anything about defence disclosure, because I think that raises different issues and has different rationales from prosecution disclosure. And the paper is principally concerned with disclosure of unused material. And for people who may not be completely familiar with this topic, this is material which the police gather during the course of an investigation, which the prosecution do not propose to use in evidence at the forthcoming trial. The prosecution do, of course, have duties to disclose the evidence on which they're going to rely, and I think many people will be familiar with the fact that problems of late disclosure are relatively common. There are sanctions available to deal with that, and again, it's not a topic that I particularly want to develop now. It might be helpful just to make a couple of quick points about the legal framework for disclosure. It is contained in the Criminal Procedure and Investigations Act of 1996. The key provision is Section 3, under which the prosecution have an initial duty of disclosure, which involves them disclosing to the accused any prosecution material which has not previously been disclosed and which might reasonably be considered capable of undermining the case for the prosecution or of assisting the case for the accused. So that's an objective test, material which might reasonably be considered capable of undermining the case for the prosecution or of assisting the case for the accused. And that's backed up by a duty of continuing disclosure as the case progresses. Now, the procedure for how this works starts with the police. There has to be a designated disclosure officer who may or may not be an investigating officer of the offence in question, and he or she is required to prepare schedules of the unused material. And those schedules are divided between non-sensitive material and the sensitive material which might be the subject of a claim for PII. The non-sensitive material should be listed separately and in sufficient detail to enable the prosecutor to decide whether the material needs to be inspected before deciding whether to disclose it to the defence. Now, in addition, the disclosure officer is required to prepare a report for the prosecutor which is supposed to identify any material in either schedule which the officer believes to satisfy the CPI test for disclosure. So at this stage, the police officer is being asked basically to apply a legal test in Section 3 of the CPIA. And these schedules should then be submitted to the prosecutor as part of the case submission process. The prosecutor is supposed to examine them, challenge any that the prosecutor regards as inadequate, and to insist on how far on the police producing a fully compliant schedule. So that's basically the framework and how the scheme is supposed to work. The first review that I wanted to say something about is the one that was carried out by Lord Justice Gross in 2011. This was done at the request of the Lord Chief Justice and was prompted by concerns as to the operation of the CPIA regime, which had been raised by judges and practitioners. So that report had no empirical base. It was essentially looking at sort of anecdotal issues, and it wasn't a Law Commission-style re-examination of the entire disclosure regime. The focus, Lord Justice Gross said, was basically on cases which raised a lot of heavy documentation, particularly serious fraud. But the review did go on to address some more general issues. And it identified a number of issues, particularly the burden on the police of scheduling unused material and the problems of dealing with a lot of electronic material. The response of that report, broadly speaking, was that everybody should do their existing jobs better, and there should be better training for the police, more common sense in scheduling. CPS ought to smarten up their act a bit and have greater communication with the police about disclosure issues. That's a very quick summary of quite a complex report, but I think that's more or less the essence of it. Now, the other report, I think, is a particularly interesting one. This was the joint HMCPSI and HMIC report, which was published in July last year. And that was concerned with disclosure in volume Crown Court cases, and so had a much broader focus than the Gross Review. It also had a different methodology and had a very substantial empirical base, which I haven't got time to describe, but it seems to me that this was a very thorough report which had a substantial database. And the conclusion that this report came up with is pretty devastating. And if you'll allow me, I'll just like to read one paragraph of the summary of the review, which says, "The inspection found that police scheduling is routinely poor. While revelation by the police to the prosecutor of material that may undermine the prosecution case or assist the defence is rare, prosecutors fail to challenge poor quality schedules and in turn provide little or no input to the police. Neither party is managing sensitive material effectively, and prosecutors are failing to manage ongoing disclosure. To compound matters, the auditing process surrounding disclosure decision-making falls far below any acceptable standard of performance. The failure to grip disclosure issues early often leads to chaotic scenes later outside the courtroom, where last minute and often unauthorized disclosure between counsel, unnecessary adjournments, and ultimately discontinued cases are common occurrences. This is likely to reflect badly on the criminal justice system in the eyes of victims and witnesses." Well, that's a pretty devastating critique of a regime that has now been in operation for 20 years. Again, though, the review really basically came to much the same recommendations as the Gross Review, basically saying that, well, everybody has got to improve what they do, they need to do their jobs better, the police need to be better trained, the CPS need to have better auditing practices, there should be more communication between the CPS and the police, and so on. They do call for a change in attitude and a cultural shift. Both reviews did this, but neither of them made any attempt to analyse what would be involved in a change of attitude and a cultural shift. And it's for that reason that I think these reviews are, in a sense, sort of failing to do the job that they really ought to have done. I have a list in the paper of the recent cases that started in December. I'm not going to go through all those. I hope the paper might get distributed at some stage if it hasn't already been. But as I said at the beginning, they do, almost all of them, deal with sexual offences in which there are credibility contests between complainant and defendant. And it's clear that those credibility issues are causing some major problems for disclosure. And so with that background, I want to now turn to this question of roles and culture and skills. We are, of course, living with an adversarial system of criminal justice. And it's not surprising, I think, to find an adversarial mindset on the part of the police. And if one looks at the research that's been done on police culture over quite a number of years now, it reveals that, generally speaking, the police have the attitude that they own an investigation, that their conception of their role is to identify a suspect and then to build a case against that suspect. And if that case, in due course, produces a conviction, that's a result. Now, I'm not intending to criticise that mindset, because it seems to me that that is actually how, in reality, the police generally work. And moreover, you can argue that in terms of public policy, this incentivises the police to bring criminals to justice. They have a sense, if you like, a sense of mission. So I'm not necessarily suggesting this is a bad thing, but the problem then is that if we require the police to operate a disclosure regime which involves them in identifying material which may help the defence or undermine the case that they're producing, what we are doing is setting up a conflict between duty and interest. interest is in making a case against the identified suspect, but their duty is then possibly to start blowing holes in that case. And that led me on to think that what about the skills that are required to operate the disclosure regime? Now the test, as I said before, is this case of an objective test of what is capable of undermining the case for the prosecution or assisting the case for the accused. So what we're asking the police to do is basically to act like a defence lawyer, to identify material, for example, which might damage the credibility of the complainant whose case they are taking forward. Well, you know, I've been an evidence lawyer for many years now, and questions of what evidence might go to damage someone's credibility is a complex issue. And I have enough trouble trying to explain to students what the finality rule involves and the exceptions to it. And to expect a police officer to engage in this sort of exercise, I think, is asking quite a lot. It's one thing if a witness has previous convictions for perverting the course of justice. That's not a difficult issue that they ought to be disclosed, but there could be a lot of other issues, particularly when you're looking at, say, social media material, messages that somebody may have sent. Do they tend to undermine the statements that that person has given to the police? Could, in many cases, be extremely arguable. And that leads me on to the second concern that I have about the skills and the attitudes that are involved here. There has been a policy whereby the police are instructed to believe the evidence which is given to them by complainants of sexual offences. This was a policy that was introduced nationally a little while ago to improve the treatment of victims of crime generally and to encourage other victims to come forward. Now, I don't want to, again, to criticise that policy as such. I think it's certainly better than the policy which some police forces appeared to adopt some years ago of basically treating complainants with scepticism. But the danger of the policy is that it can lead to what psychologists call confirmation bias. And that is the tendency for someone to ignore or devalue information which doesn't fit with what they either believe or want to believe. I've started delving into the psychological literature on this, and it is enormous, and I've really only scratched the surface. But I think some of the material that I've read certainly is food for thought for anyone who is thinking about how professions like the police should go about investigating stories that they are being told. And I do wonder whether confirmation bias could be part of the explanation for some of the problems of disclosure in these recent cases. That's the police. In relation to the prosecution, the study that Hannah Quirk produced some years ago suggested that some CPS prosecutors demonstrated very adversarial attitudes and a dislike of having to produce material to the defence. And again, there's some tension here between the idea that the prosecutor is part of the adversarial process, but is also subject to the ideology of being a minister of justice and has a duty to act fairly. And of course, there's lots of statements in the literature about that. Whether that will mean that in all cases, prosecutors will feel that it's appropriate to interrogate the police schedules as they ought to, or whether they will try and, as it were, work round schedules that they find or might well be defective, is a debatable matter. The review that I mentioned last year suggested that in practice, there is a culture, at least in some CPS areas, of trying to work round problems of police schedules and not engaging in, as it were, sort of overt challenge to the police. There is a question, of course, of whether, again, CPS prosecutors do have the experience and the skills necessary to apply the CPIA test properly. Quirk suggested in her piece that maybe that is not always the case, that perhaps some prosecutors don't have particularly defence experience in criminal litigation and might not always be aware of what might be needed or what might be useful to challenge the credibility of a complainant. So, just to conclude, where do we go from here? Well, I've suggested that the reviews have largely come up with some suggestions about better training, better communication, better leadership from the top. And one can't really quarrel with any of that. I mean, it all makes good sense, but does it go far enough? And the recent cases might suggest that even after 20 years, we still haven't resolved these issues sufficiently. So what are the options? Well, one is the keys to the warehouse approach, which is basically turning the whole thing over to the defence. So the defence would then see all the unused material. We'd get rid of schedules. The police would simply, as it were, ship over to the defence everything that they've got, apart from material that might be subject to PII. That was used at one time, but was dropped some years ago. And the Gross Review was very critical of any kind of suggestion that this should be revived. So in practice, it seems to me that's not going to happen. So what are the other options? Well, if I'm right, that what we need in applying the CPI test correctly, and I should say at this point that the reviews don't find any problem with the law. They think the law is okay. It's the way that it's actually being applied in practice. Then we have to have the involvement of an independent and impartial and experienced criminal lawyer at a much earlier stage. Whether this is going to be independent prosecution counsel is a possibility. I'd be interested to hear, particularly from the practitioners, whether they think that's feasible or desirable. And there's obviously going to be a cost involved, but it might be offset to some extent by costs, savings in police and CPS budgets. Another option, which I really float as a kind of sort of off-the-wall suggestion, is when the police forces should be able to call on the services of independent and impartial lawyers, for example, retired circuit judges, who would have the experience and the seniority to identify material that ought to be disclosed, meeting the CPIA test. I've no idea really whether this is one that could fly, but I am putting it forward as a possible pilot scheme in issues where credibility contests, in cases where credibility contests are involved. So that's a nutshell. Okay.
Very much for that. My name is Alex Chalk. I'm the Member of Parliament for Cheltenham, as just been indicated, and I sit on the Justice Select Committee and also chair the All Party Parliamentary Group on Pro Bono. I'd love to begin by, first of all, thanking you very much for inviting me, and I'm conscious that I'm amongst some extremely distinguished academics, and it's a great pleasure for me to be here to offer a few thoughts of my own on the excellent paper that you've just heard summarised. I thought it might be helpful to say a little bit about my background. So I'm still a barrister at 6KW, spent 15 years or so, and my background was in principally prosecuting and defending terrorism, serious fraud, homicide, and I still do technically have my practicing certificate, and I had the great pleasure of being against Paul Jarvis in the Court of Appeal about 2 weeks ago. So there you go. And I can tell you the sound of Court of Appeal judges cooing at his submissions was very difficult for me to bear. But he, extremely distinguished practitioner he is, and it was a pleasure. So, last bit of background before I engage, I hope reasonably concisely with the points that have been helpfully set out. A case that I did in 2009 but into 2010 underpins why I have, since I've been in Parliament, take a very strong interest in this issue of disclosure. I'll explain why. But I've asked a number of questions in Parliament about disclosure, particularly of the Attorney General, and did so before the Liam Allen case broke, because it was clear to me that this was a problem that was coming down the track, and we didn't need the Liam Allen case to explain that this was an issue that we were going to have to grapple with. And acutely mindful as I am of the point which has been made, which does bear emphasis, which is that you cannot have a fair criminal justice system without a fair and robust system of disclosure, it struck me that this was a matter of immense significance. And I'm sorry to have to say that the Liam Allen case is something that we as a society and Parliament, and no doubt the government, should have seen coming down the track a long time before. And that's relevant to a point I want to make at the end. So what was it about my experience that led me to that conclusion? Well, as I say, in 2010, I was prosecuting for the Serious Fraud Office, a guy called Eddie Davenport, who gained a bit of notoriety for a while in the 1980s for the gatecrasher balls. You look like somebody who went to one. No, anyway, the gatecrasher balls, and he was a bit of a villain, as it turned out. Now, the reason why it was significant was because the SFO were working on a very tight time frame, and they gathered huge amounts of material. And so the prosecution, I was junior prosecuting counsel, and we had to work on a very tight timetable. We had about 6 months to look through all this stuff. And there was just a sense, basically, of this case risks becoming unprosecutable because it was in the relatively early days of seizing vast amounts of digital material. How on earth are we fairly going to consider this? So what you do is you get a disclosure document. And then, in other words, setting out what all the parameters are, the sorts of issues that we think, anticipating what the defence are going to be running, that we want to look into so that we can somehow do justice. Then so we produce one of these documents, and then we had to get from the independent bar, and this is going to inform my response to your suggestions, 16 counsel from the independent bar to come in to review this vast amount of material. People in the SFO started to get quite indignant about this because we were mopping up large proportions of the SFO's budget in council's fees to go through all this material which had to be considered to comply with a court order. And it was immensely time-consuming. And it was in part as a result of that case that Lord Justice Gross looked, as has already been indicated, about how on earth we go about dealing with disclosure in respect to fraud cases, because there is a very real concern that in a bid to try to do justice, you end up making frauds unprosecutable. And exactly as has been indicated, and by the way, I agree entirely with the analysis, but I'm afraid not with the proposed solutions, I'll explain why in a moment, but that Lord Justice Gross said precisely that. Look, everyone's got to do their job better. We need to have block scheduling. So in other words, where you seize a whole load of emails, instead of itemizing every email and what it says and describing it, which of course would be absurdly laborious, you just say a load of emails between 2010 and 2014 between A and B. So that's how you schedule it. And also indicated that there should be these disclosure management documents, which effectively the defence can see and say, ah, right, that's how the CPS have gone about it, and then they can challenge it if they need to. And then exactly as has been indicated, in 2017, HMCPSI, which Her Majesty's CPS Inspectorate, as you know, and Her Majesty's Inspectorate of Constabulary, produced their damning report of the bulk cases. Now, I mention that and dwell on it for a second because they gave evidence to us on the Justice Select Committee about 3 weeks ago. And the point I want to make before going into the detail is across the House, there was this clear sense that things have gone spectacularly badly wrong. So, although in this political climate, perhaps more than at any other time in history, issues of criminal justice have to struggle to be heard amidst the sound and fury of Brexit, the NHS, and social care, and goodness knows what, there was a collective sense that things have gone quite seriously wrong and need to be addressed. And I just want to pull out some of the points that have already been neatly canvassed, but again, I just want to emphasise because I think they inform what the solution should be. And I want to make clear, of course, I don't speak for the government. These are my personal views, but they are views that the government appears to be listening to up to a point. So, exactly as is indicated, Act 1, Scene 1, the first problem is police officers are not scheduling this stuff properly. So either they don't schedule it at all, because don't forget, police officers can say, well, look, actually, this is irrelevant, because there is still technically a relevance issue. If they make a judgment that it's not relevant, they can probably say, well, we're not sticking it on a schedule. But of course, you know, this is an art, not a science. So that's the first problem. Stuff wasn't going onto the schedule, which should have gone onto the schedule. Second, it was being poorly described, Why is that important? Because when the CPS were receiving this stuff, no doubt hard-pressed CPS caseworkers who've got, and lawyers who've got squillions of cases, were taking it at face value. So in other words, if it was poorly scheduled, they would just suck it up, using plain English. They weren't going back and saying, you know, this is hopeless. You must have had seized other stuff. Or this description of, I exaggerate to make the point, a load of emails, doesn't really help. Or a load of clothing is no good. But in fact, CPS case lawyers were just saying, okay, well, I'll see what I can do with that. All right, a load of clothing, CND, clearly not disclosable. Now, the problem, that's the fruit of the poison tree, isn't it? The problem is that the scheduling is hopeless in the first place. And then the other business about the MG6E, in other words, that piece of paper which the police officers are meant to say to the prosecutor, say, look, we've looked at all this stuff, and by the way, this could be really quite tasty stuff. There could be material here which might reasonably be expected to assist the defence or undermine the case of the prosecution. Here it is. In the context of a case where we've always said that the defendant was the man, was a white male, this statement, which we've covered, where someone said, oh, I saw the defendant running from the scene and he was a black male, you know, the police officer should send something to the CPS saying, you might want to look at this. This should probably be disclosed to the defence. And that's routinely not happening. So you're absolutely correct. And so the recommendations that were made is that, please, can we train police officers better? Can we have things like disclosure champions, was the suggestion. So in every police force, we should have a disclosure champion. And we should have this culture change. And that's all really important. So where do I think that takes us? Well, where I agree with Professor Dennis is that there is a concern at the moment that police officers do have, and I thought it was a very elegant phrase, if I may say, so a conflict between duty and interest. Putting it bluntly, a police officer, notwithstanding that they've got a duty to pursue all reasonable lines of inquiry, whether they lead towards or against, they will like to think, I've got my man, right? And I want to build a case to fit that. So in those circumstances, do we sit there and just go, oh, well, that's it. Nothing we can do. The police officer, effectively, they're institutionally prosecution-minded, so we just have to hold up our hands and try and get other people to come in. Well, it's an elegant suggestion, but no, I fundamentally disagree. And I disagree for two reasons. First, there is an issue of practicality, because I think what is being suggested is that in fact you should bring in independent counsel who aren't the not the CPS prosecutor to come in early to start vetting things. That has a resource implication which is absolutely vast. You would effectively need, at a stroke, to probably add a third to the headcount of the Crown Prosecution Service. Or if you're going to do it by the independent bar, you probably need to double the size of the independent bar. And there certainly isn't the manpower, and there sure as hell isn't the budget. So I think it's a nice idea, and I think it's a council of perfection, but I'm afraid I don't think it is practical at all. I don't mean that discourteously, but I really think that that's a nice idea, but it wouldn't work. Equally with retired judges, even if they wanted to do it, which in my experience is questionable, I don't think there is anything like enough. So, in fact, what you do, I think, is you have to focus on what is the root of this poison tree, and it is about scheduling. Reason why I say that is because so long as you get the scheduling right, the other stuff doesn't matter quite as much. So although there is an issue about whether the police officers are writing to the CPS and saying, oh, by the way, we've got this witness statement which says that it was a black male, not a white male, so long as the scheduling is good, witness statement of somebody who saw the incident, then that is going to be the best route towards getting justice, because if the prosecutor doesn't pick it up, defence ought to pick it up by looking through the schedule. So do we say, well, do you know what, the police officers are either unwilling, incapable, ill-suited, ethically impossible for them to do it? No, I don't agree with that. Why don't I agree with that? Not just because I think all coppers are great, because they're not. But we have an example in our own criminal justice history where we've got round this situation. It's called the Police and Criminal Evidence Act 1984. Because as any practitioner will tell you, or any judge will tell you if they have experience, there was huge problems. We know in the 1970s of defendants being verbaled up, you know, that's to say police officers saying, well, of course, you did admit this in this interview that we had with us, didn't you? You actually admitted the offence. Well, no, I didn't admit the offence at all. And there was a whole lot of litigation. So how did they get around that? They introduced the Police and Criminal Evidence Act, which had codes of practice, which says stuff like, you may not interview a suspect at the scene. You have to take them down to the police station. You've got to make sure that it's properly recorded. There have to be rest breaks. You have to make sure there's the right to a lawyer, etc., etc. Now, you might think police officers would consider this an egregious infringement upon... it's infantilising police officers. Not a bit of it. Police officers I've spoken to hugely welcome that structure. So they like to know that when they take a suspect into custody, when should the rest break be? What should the rules be in terms of providing them with lawyers and all that kind of stuff? And now that provides, in my view, the key to how we go about solving this. And it needs to be PACE-style codes as to how they go about scheduling. Because as I say, if the schedules are right, it's the best chance to achieve justice. So how could this work in practice? Well, it's obviously a matter of careful thought. But for example, I think we ought to be saying, so far as emails are concerned, under this code for scheduling unused material, there'll be a code on emails, and it should be that, that there should be a bulk scheduling of emails between A and B, between person A and person B, insofar as it's relevant. And if it's to do with clothing, there should be a schedule, which a code which says what you ought to be doing when you're scheduling clothing. In other words, a guide to an officer so that he or she can look at it and say, well, am I broadly along the right lines? The reason why I wasn't attracted to the idea of a disclosure champion in every police force, because although that's a great idea in principle, it still comes down to the fact that this can be an art as much as a science, and therefore even that individual disclosure champion could take a different view as to whether, you know, precisely how one should be approaching this issue. I think we should be trying to make it as scientific as possible and as unartistic as possible, and I think that's where you need codes. The last thing I want to say is this. The defence need to be brought into the process far earlier. Not giving them the keys to the warehouse, which is wrong for all the reasons that Lord Justice Gross said, not least because it would suddenly create a huge resource issue because the defence would say, well, you've given us all this stuff, we've got to look at it. And then prosecutions could run into the ground for that reason because they would all drag on, etc. No, what we need to do is at early hearings, in my view, particularly with digital material, we should be saying, right, to the defence, there's a whole load of digital material. We are going to be running search terms through this material. What search terms do you want us to run? And at that early hearing, maybe it should be at the PTPH or even in the magistrate's court, saying to them, OK, it's a sex case. It's a sex case between John and Jane. We're going to be running the search terms of John and Jane. We're going to be running search terms, the word sex or last night or whatever it is that's appropriate in the search, or the bar that they were supposed to have gone to. Do you have any other search terms that you think we should be putting in? And I think that is a way that you would arrive at a better system. Mindful of the fact that this is extremely difficult to get a perfect system. But in summary then, I think whilst the suggestion is an extremely elegant and ingenious one, I think it bumps up against resource issues. The best way to deal with it is to focus on the issue of scheduling by providing codes of practice, which I think police officers will consider to be of assistance rather than infantilising them. And ensuring that when it comes to digital material, the defence are brought into the process as early as possible and invited to do what they reasonably can to ensure that justice is achieved for their client. Those are my representations.
Thank you very much.